live executions. If it was low cost, it could be shot in a studio in Glendale.
Wait, I thought I was hosting this. Who's that guy?
I'm Dutch, the producer. Who are you?
I'm John f***ing Legend.
And I'm John f***ing Horn. There's a strange and funny new sketch comedy show called Sherman Showcase. You're hearing its theme music, and the guys who made it are here with us.
When people are at their worst point, if you can make them laugh, you've brought light into their life in a way that I think is important and special.
Later on in the show, an indie rock duo pays tribute to Van Halen, but without the band's famous guitars. And Patricia Arquette's career is on fire, and no one is more surprised than she is.
Well, it's very weird because I didn't see this coming, but I feel like I'm getting the best parts of my life, and I'm 51. And I think a big part of that has to do with this conversation, questioning our industry.
It's all on The Frame Weekend from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. I'm John Horn. Stay with us. I'm John Horn, and this is The Frame Weekend. On this show, we talk with creative people about how and why they do what they do and about how their art is shaped by the wider world. Later today, we'll talk with the filmmakers who followed some undocumented immigrants as they infiltrated a detention center to try to free people awaiting deportation. But we'll start with Otherhood. It's about three moms whose kids are grown, and the women are all trying to figure out what they're going to do next in their lives.
Motherhood.
That sinking feeling that as your child's growing up, that you're being broken up with on a gradual but daily basis. It's inhumane emotional waterboarding.
That is the best description of motherhood I have ever heard.
Mm-hmm. Well, at this stage, it doesn't feel like motherhood. It feels like otherhood.
The film co-stars Patricia Arquette, Angela Bassett, and Felicity Huffman. And let's first talk about Felicity Huffman before we talk about the movie. She'll be sentenced next month for her involvement in the college admissions scandal to which she's pled guilty. And her arrest actually delayed the original release of Otherhood. It was supposed to coincide with Mother's Day. Here's what the film's producer, Kathy Schulman, had to say on the issue.
When we made the film with Felicity, obviously we had no idea what might happen later. And it was a terrific experience all around, an amazing collaboration, frankly, of five or six or seven women in their 50s, of which she was one. And when this actually happened, it had a sort of interesting mirroring effect, you know, to the film itself, in the sense that mothering is really, really hard. And even Felicity's character in the movie, you know, she has to make some really, really hard decisions. And she goes through a lot of hell before she learns to love herself again. And interestingly enough, we have not seen it, you know, affecting the film so far. People are starting to see it. And what's exciting is when, you know, those who write about it say what a terrific performance she actually has given in this. But, you know, I think that, yeah, she's having an intense second chapter here. And the movie is really all about second chapters.
It's directed by Cindy Shupak. She was a writer-producer on Sex and the City. She also adapted the screenplay. She and producer Kathy Schulman struggled for a decade to get it made. The major obstacle? The leads were women in their 50s.
It was always about empty nesting. It kind of was about a stage of life. And then we were just discussing, they're not mothers anymore. What are they? And I came up with Otherhood from my extensive pun experience on Sex and the City.
It was a really funny moment when she said it, because the scene that you just played imitates what happened when we were sitting across the table from one another. And we just were like, that is the best description of what we're experiencing we could possibly imagine. And then it's so much fun to see Patricia say those words, because we had the same experience creating the title itself.
Yeah, it is a really harsh, I don't know, like a rite of passage or whatever that period in life is. It feels horrendous, because everything in your body as a mother is prone to taking care of your children. I mean, our eyes get bad during pregnancy, our bones get weaker. I mean, even our physical bodies give everything it can to our child. So once you're sort of discarded, thrown away like an old used handkerchief, then it's a horrible feeling.
But there is a bright side. I mean, I guess there's something about this story about kinship and about finding people who are going through similar things and strength in numbers.
Strength in numbers. I like that. And also that your children, you know, you want them to individuate and move away. But I think part of the argument that all three of these moms have is, sure, it's great, we want you to have your own life, but don't forget us and don't be disrespectful towards us. And, you know, we can still love each other and stay connected, be an adult and have your own life. But, you know, I love you and I want you to love and respect me. And I think there's a subconscious thing, too, in the way that we've been from the nuclear family, from 1950s Americana and before, where I do think we've taken mothers for granted. And it's a subconscious bias. And I would like us to have that conversation about shifting that relationship and also respecting our elders, which I don't think we do a great job of in America.
We're talking with producer Kathy Schulman, writer-director Cindy Shupak, and actor Patricia Arquette about their new movie, Otherhood.
Basically, there's this age group, and it kind of is 49 to 69, that's like this forgotten female generation. You know, we're mothers and then we're grandmothers, or that's what everyone thinks. But what about those 20 years in between where we're still working? We're oftentimes at the height of our careers, might be in second careers. There sometimes are second marriages. Somebody might have died. You know, your children are leaving. Your sensuality and sexuality is in question. Your relationships with your husbands and lovers, you suddenly think you should have sex with a lifeguard. Things are weird, you know, during this period.
She keeps bringing up that example. Well, I don't know who this guy is.
I don't know. I say that because, you're right, I experienced that heavily. No, I think
his name is Mark.
20 minutes ago.
Malibu, lifeguard station 27.
What I'm referencing is this idea that there's nothing more terrifying for a woman than society saying that after you do this heavy lifting of motherhood, which is up until a child is 18 to 20, that then you're a grandmother. A grandmother's a great stage, but it's very far along from where many women in middle age are actually living and experiencing things. And there's a lot of life to have. And that's what's the fun of Otherhood, the movie, because they go to New York, these three moms, with this agenda to fix their relationships with their adult sons as if that's possible. But what happens instead is they realize who they are.
I don't think it's just society that assigns this value to motherhood. I think it's also comes from us, and it's a subconscious kind of bias we ourselves carry. So in this movie with these friends, I think they do start to go, hold on a minute, I'm going to renegotiate this life. Mm-hmm. I don't know when I agreed to that or how I agreed to that or what happened exactly, but I want to have a different life now.
I'm going to add something to that because it is societal and it's internal and it's pop culture. And pop culture through television, through film, through books, through advertising shapes expectations of how people are supposed to look, how they're supposed to behave. And you guys all know this, that there are certain things that women can and cannot do behind and in front of the camera. And there's certain kinds of characters they can and cannot play. And there are certain kinds of ways that they have to be seen and not upset those norms. And that is part of how the characters in this story start to think about themselves, because they're conditioned by that onslaught through popular culture.
I mean, I think there's also something where sometimes agents don't want their clients, actresses, to play a mom of an adult person. Like, you know, there's a feeling that you're now crossing over into an area and then that's who you are. So then you can't, like you
move
said.
Move into the dead zone.
Yeah.
Like, well, are you ready to move into the dead zone?
Your last day sketch with Amy Schumer. So true.
We have it queued up. Let's listen to your last day with Amy Schumer.
Well, I just had an audition for Mrs. Claus.
You're kidding me.
I read for that part.
I read for that too.
You did?
Yes.
Hey, who got that?
J-Lo.
Oh, she'll be good.
She's going to be really good.
Really good. Mm. Or you go to a movie set, you go to wardrobe, mm-hmm. and the only thing they have for you to wear are long sweaters, like cover you up head to toe kind of thing. Where like the poster for your movie is just like a picture of the kitchen.
Yeah.
With these very uplifting and yet vague titles like Whatever It Takes or She Means Well. That kind of thing, right?
Last day is kind of saying like we're about to be marginalized, as opposed to this movie hopefully puts these women front and center. Their stories are valuable and they're kind of extraordinary, ordinary characters. They're not playing the mom. They're playing women who have adult sons.
And this is a damn momity, people. Okay?
Oh, yeah, it's a momity.
About time we have a momity.
I was thinking on the way over that, because I was asked a little bit about like, you know, momity chick flick, and you know, chick flick could only have become a term because men decided to identify which movies they didn't want to watch. No woman decided, let's call these chick flicks. And so until there's dick flicks, I've decided, or prick flicks, or dick or prick lit, I don't want to call it that.
Kathy Schulman is the producer of Otherhood. Cindy Shupak is its writer-director, and Patricia Arquette stars in the film. Kathy, Cindy, and Patricia, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Otherhood is streaming now on Netflix. You're listening to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn, and now's the time of the show when we discuss a top news story from the weekend culture. Today, we're calling it Tarantino versus Bruce Lee. Joining me to discuss what's at the heart of the controversy between the filmmaker and the legend action star slash martial arts expert is LA Times film writer Jen Yamato. Hey, Jen.
Hello, hello.
So, Jen, you wrote a piece called Bruce Lee's Family Calls Once Upon a Time a Mockery. Is it insult or homage? Or, if you want to say it differently, homage. Let's start with how Bruce Lee is portrayed in the movie. Here's a clip. It's Mike Mo playing Bruce Lee and Brad Pitt, who plays a stuntman in the film, going mano a mano.
My hands are registered as lethal weapons. We get into a fight, I accidentally kill you, I go to jail.
Anybody accidentally kills anybody in a fight, they go to jail. It's called manslaughter.
So let's talk a little bit about what happens in this scene. Brad Pitt is playing a badass stuntman, and he encounters Bruce Lee on the set. And Cliff Booth, who is Brad Pitt's character, and Bruce Lee have a little fight. And let's just say that Brad Pitt gets the better of Bruce Lee. Fair enough, would you say?
I think that is exactly the crux of the argument here, is how people see the scene, starting from the very question, does Bruce Lee get beaten? And from there, whether or not you see it as they come to an even draw because it's best out of three and they get stopped before round three, or if you sort of measure the degree to which, you know, Brad Pitt coolly getting knocked down and Bruce Lee being thrown so hard into a car that he leaves a dent are equal in measure. I think that is part, but not even the whole of the argument here.
Let's talk briefly about Bruce Lee and who he was and where he was in his movie career at that time. His landmark movie, Enter the Dragon, has not yet come out. Let's play a little clip from Enter the Dragon. It's basically a fight scene, and Bruce Lee is fighting a very tough guy and getting the best of him. So Bruce Lee is an incredible fighter, great martial arts star, and at this point in his career where the movie is unfolding, he's doing Green Hornet, right? He is Kato in the Green Hornet. So that's the coincidence of the encounter?
Well, even that setup is, I think, worthy of going a little more into detail for, because we know that the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is set in 1969. And more specifically, it is set in this hazy, dreamy memory version of 1969 Hollywood that Tarantino remembers and is recreating, is representing. And the flashback that we see Bruce Lee in takes place on the set of Green Hornet, which only ran from 1966 to 67. So it is a flashback in time, temporally, within the world of this film. And at the time of Green Hornet, Bruce Lee played Kato, the sidekick to the star, Green Hornet. And while it was certainly one of his most iconic early works, he was not appreciated at the time, and he didn't feel appreciated by Hollywood either. After the show ended, he had to leave Hollywood. He had to go overseas to become a star in Asia before being able to come back and get his flowers at home. And the tragedy of that is that Enter the Dragon didn't come out till after his untimely tragic death. So really, we have only collectively truly appreciated him in death. But that also, I think, begs more consideration of why Tarantino is using this specific moment in Bruce Lee's career to bring him into the film.
There are so many different ways to look at this scene, but let's talk about how Bruce Lee's family is viewing the scene. I think it's fair to say they're unhappy with it. What is the nature of their argument, and what do they feel is wrong about the scene and about the way that Bruce Lee is depicted.
Bruce Lee's family was not consulted ahead of time like Sharon Tate's family was, for example. And so I spoke with Shannon Lee, who's the daughter of Bruce Lee, after she had seen the film for herself last weekend, opening weekend. So she did not comment on the actual depiction until she saw it with her own eyes. And what she told me was that she found it very disrespectful, a caricature, not character, and not at all like what her father was. And I think a lot of fans of Bruce Lee agree with her. Now, then you get into the conversation of, is Bruce Lee in the film supposed to be depicted as he was, or is this subject to artistic license because this is a flashback or a dreamy flashback subject to the perspective of Brad Pitt's character?
What has Quentin Tarantino said, if anything, about what he was after in this scene?
Right. Well, Tarantino has not done a ton of interviews, period, about this movie. So he has not really spoken that much explaining this. Although when he was doing the press tour pre-release, he described it as a scene in which it's meant to show that Cliff has these killer capabilities, so to speak. I'm paraphrasing.
Jen Yamato is a film writer at the LA Times. She's the author of the article Bruce Lee's Family Calls Once Upon a Time a Mockery. Is it insult or homage? The other thing that I think was interesting in your article is that in audiences who are watching the scene, there's some laughter that feels almost as if it's directed at Bruce Lee, that there's some derision. And it's not just uncomfortable laughter, it feels almost mockery. Is that something that you have heard from people who have seen the movie?
Certainly. And I for this story in the LA Times, it was very important for me to get a diversity of opinion on this. I included perspectives from film critics and cultural critics about that scene, very specifically about that scene in the historical context of who was Bruce Lee and why did he mean so much to people that they might take offense? And what I have heard from many of the Asian Americans that I spoke to about the scene is that they felt uncomfortable. Many people felt uncomfortable in the theater hearing laughter from the audience around them that felt like it was laughter at Bruce Lee's expense. And that's where the reading that this is mockery comes in. That's where the reading that that the racial undertones inherent to the scene, even its premise, are, I think, worthy of deeper examination.
Jen, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, they write, they act, they sing, and they make social commentary about race in America, and they're very funny. The creators of the new sketch comedy show Sherman Showcase. That's next on The Frame Weekend. This is The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn, and this music is the theme to Sherman Showcase. It's a new sketch comedy show that's the brainchild of Bashir Salahuddin and Diallo Riddle. The writers and performers worked on Jimmy Fallon's late night show and spent years trying to get their own shows off the ground. But this week, they actually premiered two new series. The scripted show Southside is on Comedy Central, and Sherman Showcase is on IFC. Here's how Salahuddin and Riddle describe the through line between the two shows.
You know, coming from a blue collar background, both of us do, from working class families, you know, humor is necessary. Particularly almost sometimes a gallows humor when you deal with certain realities. And so I have always...
Which realities might those be?
Oh, you know, life on the South Side.
I haven't watched the news for a couple of years.
I was just going to say that, like, I feel so blessed because I think comedy is an ameliorative. I think comedy is something where you can... I think it's a blessing. I think it's a healing. I think it's like when people are at their worst point, if you can make them laugh, if you can make a friend laugh, you've brought light into their life in a way that I think is important and special. And I have a high opinion of that. And so for us, we were doing our show. I said, look, we want to make shows where folk can come home, kick their feet, kind of like A Living Color was for us. You kick your feet up and you just laugh. You laugh so hard. And so the other through line for our work is
there's always some social commentary.
There's always some commentary. Yeah, even if we don't want it to be, somebody will point out and say, like, hey, man.
It's never been our goal.
Y'all took down the prison industrial complex was tight. I'm like, did we do that?
but we kind of do. And I think that, you know, we never want to be polemic because then we think you lose people. Right. I think if anything, we sort of sneak it under the radar and they're like, oh my God, did they just make the third joke about the LAPD in one episode?
Yeah. You know, both of us will have a sense of humor about it. And I think that comes, it goes into the work.
One of the things I love the most about our show is that we usually use something to stand in for something else. And I know in the case of Sherman Showcase, we actually use the city of Glendale.
You sure do.
We use the city of Glendale as a stand-in for Hollywood.
Yeah.
Because almost for old Hollywood, outside, too. Most people outside of out of Los Angeles don't really think of Glendale, or if they do, they don't consider
or know
really
it exists.
They don't think of it as a separate entity. But I love the fact that Sherman is very proud of the fact that his studio is right there in the heart of downtown Glendale.
This next lady is 5'11", 130 pounds. She's a special needs teacher here in Glendale and has herself been diagnosed with depression. Here is Hot Pants Hattie.
For a couple seasons, Sherman called his dance ensemble Sherman's Beauties. Then in the 90s, he called them Sherman's Dime Pieces. Nowadays, he calls them Sherman's Respected Dancing Future Leaders of America or some like that.
This is a radio show, but I'm going to show you a video, so you got to stay where you are. I'm going to turn my laptop around. We don't do this often, but I have to show you something.
It's time for Dance Fever, starring Denny Terrio.
Dance Fever.
The show featuring the country's top disco dancers.
Dance Fever.
Are you about to say something amazing?
Dance Fever, I think, is a show you might have stumbled upon when you're thinking about Sherman Showcase.
I would go further and say Dance Fever is a show we both know very well. Dance Fever is a show that I think it was a skosh before our time, but I remember watching that growing up. I remember seeing Dance Fever. And so aesthetically, the vibe of that is absolutely something we wanted Sherman Showcase to have.
I want to play you something from the first episode. This is how John Legend describes Sherman Showcase.
For over 40 years, Sherman Showcase has been a revolutionary black music / dance / entertainment program unlike anything else on TV. Except for several other shows.
And there's the list.
There is a list that goes by pretty fast, but there's some crazy things on it.
Yeah, Seinfeld season 5 is on there.
But you have to create two shows, basically. There is the fictional variety show.
Correct.
And then there is the documentary series looking back on the show.
Yes, and can I say one of the things that excites me and this guy, Bashir, the most is the chance to invent lore. Yeah. I always say that this show was really our chance to do the Marvel Cinematic Universe of black music. So not only have we created lore around Sherman Showcase, the fake show within a show, but we've also created backstories for all of our musical guests on the show. And let me give you a classic example. Somebody was like, well, where'd you guys come up with this song, Marina Del Rey? Well, once again, like Glendale, we like to show a little bit of light on some of LA's forgotten communities.
Let's spend the day in Marina Del Rey. Let's spend the day in Marina Del Rey.
I wanna play. It's my favorite part.
We sing the songs.
Yeah, you can harmonize.
In Marina Del Rey.
In Marina Del Rey. Yeah.
We want the key to the city of Marina Del Rey.
Absolutely.
You will get that. It comes with the key to the city of Glendale.
There it is.
Twofer.
It's like a package.
They're sister cities.
They're in the same plastic packaging. Like
and do you know what it is? When you go to a musician, you just say, we need a song that's going to be... It was, I mean, the Marina Del Rey is yacht rock, but you call it big ass boat rock. That you tell them what the place is in the show, what kind of guidance or leeway does the musician have?
Some of the songs, every song came together a little bit differently.
Totally.
I will say that the majority of these songs are original songs, the medley of which came from Bashir and I, because we're just like every other comedian out there. We secretly wanted to be musicians at some point in our lives.
Or even unsecretly.
And you get to be in the band too.
Yeah. And so like you'll send like the song idea, maybe like even like hum a few bars of what you think it sounds like to, you know, one of our collaborators. And then they'll send it back. You'll send it back and forth for a little bit. And then eventually you end up with a Marina Del Rey.
We're talking with Diallo Riddle and Bashir Salahuddin about their sketch comedy show, Sherman's Showcase. The songs are funny, but they're also produced. I mean, they could stand alone on their own.
We're smart enough to know how stupid we are. And what I mean by that is, Diallo and I are really good at comedy, I think we understand what that process is. We used to work at Fallon. We used to work 20-hour days sometimes. It is a tough process.
It was 18 hours 10 minutes ago.
It'll be 22 in 10 minutes. Let's keep it going.
26 hours.
Here's the deal. 35 hours a day, we were out there working our butts off. We brought all that, but we also got to work with somebody like Questlove, and we sort of realized both through him and at the same time that Lonely Island was doing stuff. I remember the first time I heard Lazy Sunday.
2-0-6. 0-12. Like your cousin. I told you that I'm crazy for these cupcakes, cousin. Yo, where's the movie playing? Upper West Side, dude. Well, let's hit up Yahoo Maps to find the dopest route. I prefer MapQuest. That's a good one, too. Google Maps is the best.
And I was like, man, this song goes hard without the comedy lyrics. And so we realized already, if the song is great, it just adds another layer because we love it when the music actually sounds like music. So we went to real musicians.
I will admit, with Marina Del Rey, that song wasn't even formulated when the writer's room closed. But I was like, I don't know why it's in the show, and I also don't know if I have a medley to pitch to our collaborators on it. But that's one that literally came together about 3 weeks before we shot it, and I'm super happy that it exists.
But I think we'd also had experience with Fallon, knowing there are things you plan long-term. There are sketches that they take 2 months to produce.
Wow.
They might be great. They might not. There are sketches that he comes in the morning of, or a writer says, oh my God, I had the doofiest idea last night. Let's do this. Sometimes it works, sometimes
like
it doesn't.
Like Slow Jam the News, which we worked on. We did Slow Jam the News with Obama, and that was one of the things where, like, you crank it out, you send it to his people, they come back, they're like, Obama's going to do it. You're like, yeah, I'll believe it when I see it. He comes bouncing into the room.
But I believe it is of the utmost importance to work alongside other world leaders. That's why I signed the Iran nuclear deal. That's why we reopened diplomatic ties with Cuba. And that's why I negotiated the new trade deal called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP.
Now hold on there, Prez Dispenser. Are you saying you're down with TPP?
Yeah, you know me.
You talk to him for 15 minutes. You spend the next 6 years telling people about that 15 minutes, but it's pretty awesome.
Trying to remember everything that happened in that room at that time, really. Because it's one of those few times in life where you go, this is about to be
okay,
special.
Okay, I'm about to remember this.
The music is so good, you're actually releasing the soundtrack, right?
Absolutely. It's coming out on Mad Decent, which is Diplo's label. Because John Legend was involved in this, we absolutely needed to make sure that the music was of a certain quality. Mm. And it's the last 40 years of black music. So if you're a James Brown fan, we've got a song on there that sounds quite a bit like James Brown when he had like the JBs there and Fred Wesley on the horns. You know, like we've got that sound. We've got songs that sound like they were produced by Prince or Morris Day. In fact, Morris Day is one of our guest stars on the show and he co-signed on these songs. You know, we've got songs from like 90s R&Bs.
Somebody recently described our show as, oh, this is just a really good music show with comedy. And I was like, you know what? I'm kind of with that actually, because at least that respects like the quality of the music. We're proud of the music on our show.
We're very proud of the music.
It's going to bump in your whip.
Diallo Riddle and Bashir Salahuddin are the creators and stars of the sketch comedy show Sherman Showcase. Diallo and Bashir, thanks so much for coming.
Thanks so much for having
us. Thanks for having us.
I got the showcase on Sherman.
Sherman Showcase is on Wednesday nights on IFC. You can also watch the first couple of episodes right now on YouTube, and the soundtrack drops August 9th. Southside is on Comedy Central, also on Wednesday nights, so maybe you're going to need to set your DVR. This is The Frame Weekend, and I'm John Horn. There's a new documentary called Murder in the Front Row, the San Francisco Bay Area thrash metal story. It's directed by longtime Metallica and Beastie Boys collaborator Adam Dubin. The film is about the bands and their rabid fans who embraced them in the 1980s before commercial radio and MTV got on board. The Frame contributor Stephen Cuevas has this firsthand story, and yes, he was there.
I was among the 100 or so kids who turned up for Metallica's first ever club show in San Francisco in the fall of 1982. I was 16, and there'd be tons of other shows after that when the band moved from LA to the Bay Area for good the following year, finding common cause alongside other young bands and metal fans. Back then, the music spread via cassette tapes of live shows, rehearsals, and demo tapes like this one by the band Death Angel. The music found its audience via snail mail and local college radio. In fact, my broadcast debut, It was as a teenage DJ co-hosting a weekly late-night show called Rampage Radio on a college station in San Francisco.
Hello! Hello! We're Metallica, and you're not! You're listening to KUSF!
The station was a frequent stop for bands when they wanted to plug a show or just hang out on a Saturday night.
We got Exodus in the studio. What do you guys got to say about this raging show? You know, tomorrow night's the Mab.
Tomorrow night we're burning the place to the ground.
Oh, that'll be fun to watch.
Yeah. My old friend Ron Quintana, who also turns up in the documentary, co-founded the KUSF show and was kind of the impresario of the local metal scene back then.
My 1980 music sucked. Being a kid in San Francisco, radio was going downhill disco, and luckily there was KUSF, which could play harder punk stuff.
Now here's some Exodus for all you fans.
And as director Adam Dubin discovered while making his documentary, the kids did a lot more than just go to shows.
I mean, they made fanzines and took pictures and made tapes and traded the tapes and built a following for these bands. It was a place any early band playing this kind of music would want to play.
Taping live shows with little handheld recorders was pretty common. You'd make copies of the cassettes and swap them with fans around the U.S. and Europe. I taped this show 35 years ago this summer, semi-secret Metallica Welcome Home gig at the Mabuhay Gardens, a little punk rock club in San Francisco's North Beach.
We go away for a few months, and San Francisco turns into a circus! This one goes out to all our friends! That's a noise!
Also in the crowd that night, a couple of other teenage metalheads armed with 35mm cameras. One of them was Harold Oyman.
My first roll of film, I didn't even know you had to push the button in on the bottom, and I ended up shredding the roll, so kind of learned by trial and error.
The other was Brian Liu.
Another photographer said, like, well, those are just fan photos. They're not professional photos. And I read that quote, and I was like, your point being?
Back then, Brian and Harold would wade into the scrum of flailing hair and thrashing bodies, elbowing their way to the edge of club stages to bang their heads and snap photos.
This one is dedicated to Mr. Brian Liu, whose birthday it is. It's called Metal Militia! That's crazy.
We'd get people landing on us left and right. We'd get boots to the head. I actually broke my leg once down in L.A. and the barricade actually collapsed on me. That's kind of where we came up with the name, too. Murder in the Front Row, it's perfect.
Brian and Harold's historic photos from the era were published in Murder in the Front Row, shots from the Bay Area thrash metal epicenter. The massive high school yearbook-sized pictorial became a storyboard for Adam Dubin's documentary.
It was these photos, these visceral photos of people just mashed together in clubs and on stages and hanging out. There's no record companies, there's no mainstream press, there's no money really. Yet these folks wanted to be there because it was an energy.
Hell's Breath! This is called Hell's Breath!
Energy that shared much more with punk rock than the hairspray pop metal acts of the day, such as Rat and Motley Crue. Thrash stripped away all that glitz. The line between bands and fans also vanished, says Harold Oyman.
There was this great camaraderie between the bands and everything. Luckily, Metallica were cool enough to let me hang out with them. We tended to drink quite a bit back then. I'd always forget about what happened, so I figured if I brought a camera, I could document it.
What none of us realized was that Harold and Brian were documenting the bruising birth of a music revolution, one that veteran San Francisco Chronicle music critic Joel Selvin admits in the documentary that he just didn't get. In a 1985 review, he likened Metallica to, quote, a dump truck dropping its load while somebody screams over the roar of the cascading gravel.
It wasn't even a matter of whether I understood it or not. I could tell that these people understood it, and I witnessed the extraordinary fervor and enthusiasm, and it was hard not to be swept up in it.
And for a lot of us who were there, the Bay Area thrash metal scene represents a lot more than just the music. It's about forging lasting friendships that continue to this day, and setting a course for where some of us would go with the rest of our lives.
It was a perfect storm of all the people that we needed.
Here's how Metallica lead guitarist Kirk Hammett puts it in the documentary.
And the amazing thing about it is we were all young, innocent, and didn't know what the f*** we were doing or where it all was going. It just happened. It was like from heaven. It was one of the greatest times of my life.
Oh, here I come. For The Frame, I'm Stephen Cuevas.
Murder in the Front Row, the San Francisco Bay Area thrash metal story, screens this weekend at the Frida Cinema in Santa Ana. It's in theaters around the country through September. Coming up, we meet the filmmakers of The Infiltrators. Their movie follows young, undocumented immigrants who go to extreme measures to free other immigrants on the verge of deportation. That's next on The Frame Weekend. Welcome back to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. This week, a timely and innovative film opened the Los Angeles Latino International Film Festival. The movie is called The Infiltrators. It's part documentary and part narrative film. It's about a group of activist dreamers, young undocumented immigrants, who take on America's vast deportation infrastructure. We caught up with the people who made The Infiltrators at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year. That's where the movie premiered.
I'm Alex Rivera, a filmmaker and occasionally digital media artist.
I'm Christina Ibarra. I am a filmmaker, and my film is The Infiltrators.
Everyone needs a plan. That's what my mom told me as she was carrying me north, across the border. Everyone needs a plan.
So The Infiltrators tells a true story of a small group of undocumented youth, folks that are sometimes called dreamers, back in 2010. And this group started to form around the DREAM Act, and then they started to work on stopping deportations. And at a certain point, they decided that the best place for them to do this work of stopping deportations was inside of a detention center.
They call Broward a model detention center. Minimum security, TVs in every room. Like a Florida motel, but you can't check out.
And so at the beginning of the film, you meet these characters, you meet this group, and you watch as they decide to get detained and go through this process of basically getting arrested by the Border Patrol on purpose to go into a detention center to help get people out. And so it's kind of a political heist, a jailbreak movie in reverse, and it's a true story.
The Infiltrators, once inside, work with their collaborators, a team of undocumented youth working from a safe house about 30 miles away. And once they get the safe house gets a call, they start working a case. And the way they do that is they get background information on the case, find out what district they're in so that they can figure out what lawmaker to call, what Congress member to call, to create a political pressure, a campaign to try to release them.
There's a lot of different ways that people can stay and a lot of different things that a detainee can do to delay a deportation. And so that's part of what The Infiltration is about, is getting that information in.
I'm working with a group and we're trying to get people out of here. Just wondering if I can give you their number.
Get people out?
How? Well, how'd you end up in here?
So stupid, man. I don't have a driver's license. So I was riding my bike on the sidewalk and I get stopped by the cops.
One of the main characters is Marco Saavedra, who was the first infiltrator at Broward. He went in knowing one thing about this detention center, which was that there was a man inside named Claudio Rojas. And the Rojas family had reached out to the National Immigrant Youth Alliance for help. Claudio, the father in the family, had been detained, and lawyers and everyone else told the family, I'm sorry, there's no hope. Under the Obama administration, there was this kind of rhetoric about targeting the deportation apparatus at felons, etc., you know, the baddest people, the gangbangers, so, you know, all that. But they were deporting almost 400,000 people a year. And are those really all felons? Clearly not. And Claudio on the inside was saying, there's no felons in here. This detention center is filled with everyday moms and dads. And so the activists went there to find him, to try to get him out and to expose what was really a systematic problem.
the infiltrators are almost like forcing themselves into a space that is doesn't want them in. Like they have this strong sense of belonging that is very it's very American, but yet they're not seen that way, and so it creates this kind of this creative resistance that comes from that place that they where they are. I love that sense of belonging that they carry. It's something that sometimes I feel I don't have, you know.
There's a lot of things I love about the world of the film, like that we enter through dreamers that speak English, they're very Americanized, they're immediately identifiable, but their action is in a sense about their parents. It's about the generation above them, the immigrants who are not Americanized, the immigrants who arrived recently, the immigrants who were rounded up in workplace raids or caught at a stop sign for not having a driver's license, the people who are swept up in this giant deportation machine.
In every family, I have been able to see my own family, and that's sacred. Family is sacred. What would I want someone to do for my family?
That the dreamers are kind of using their privilege, is what they call it, to enter this system and try to rescue the people who were broadly unsympathetic in this current moment, you know, and that kind of solidarity between the young generation and the old, hacking at this contradiction in our political culture, where sort of dreamers are sort of seen as sympathetic, but their parents are seen as criminals, that they're throwing their bodies at that contradiction, I think is really dramatic and provocative and, you know, could be explored in a much longer format and a bigger canvas than what we had in a 90-minute film.
Oftentimes we are used to just accepting things that we feel are not ethical or humane because that's just the way things are. And one of the things that meeting the infiltrators did for me is it reminded me that we should question what is unethical.
Christina Ibarra and Alex Rivera are the directors of The Infiltrators. It opened the Los Angeles Latino International Film Festival earlier this week. It will be released in theaters later this year. This is The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. The other day, I left the studios here at KPCC and went to go visit The Bird and the Bee. That is the indie rock duo that is composed of Inara George and Greg Kurstin. They write and record their own music, and sometimes they cover songs by some of their musical heroes. They did it previously with Hall & Oates, and now they have a new album where they're covering songs by Van Halen. That's the David Lee Roth Van Halen, not to be confused with the Sammy Hagar Van Halen.
Part of our interest in doing something like this is that it's just the sort of the universal reality that a good song is a good song, no matter in what genre it is. I mean, in David Lee Roth, he was a real, like, wordsmith.
Well, I feel like his melodies and his phrasing are really exceptional. I mean, almost like Sinatra in a way or something, like when their band is kind of doing their sort of swinging rock. I mean, it's like a shuffle they'll do or something. He's right in there, like, in his feel and his rhythm and his phrasing is really authentic. It's not easy. I mean, there's a lot of rock bands from the 80s who were doing that sort of shuffle thing, but it wasn't as soulful as, you know,
he's an insane singer. I had seen, we were supposed to go to this concert together, and it was when David Lee Roth first came back to the band. Mm-hmm. And I remember watching the show, and just David Lee Roth kind of sort of blew my mind, because I'd always thought of Van Halen as like rock and kind of edgy, and then David Lee Roth had this, it was like, are you the best showman I've ever seen? Are you in Broadway or are you in a rock band? It was like this, he walks this amazingly fine line between the two worlds, and I kind of came away with it sort of this new breath of excitement for David Lee Roth.
You make a decision at some point that you are going to remove what is probably the most recognizable sound of Van Halen's music, which is Eddie Van Halen's guitar playing. So, Greg, I want to ask you about that decision, kind of conceptually and then pragmatically, what it meant in terms of actually recording the songs once you make the decision to remove guitar.
Well, when I first got into Van Halen, I was the keyboard guy in bands, so I'd be learning these songs on keyboards, really. So I think that was sort of the initial thing, is I thought, well, I had already learned a lot of these songs on the keyboards, and it kind of, you know, I got into jazz later and improvisation and stuff like that. So, well, what if we can utilize that and I can, you know, take jazz solos instead of sort of, you know, arpeggiating rock solos to interpret Eddie's solo?
Let's listen to a little bit of your version of Eruption. So this is a song that, to people who know the music, would pose a challenge because the defining sound of Eruption is the guitar.
Yeah, I mean, I really felt we couldn't leave Eruption off, you know, this album. I felt like it's such an important part of that first album, you know, and in hearing Eddie's guitar playing, you know, it's the first time I've heard anyone really do that. It was very innovative. But I also, listening more closely to, you know, Eddie's version, I realized that it's really like a classical piece of music. There's these arpeggios and there's chord movement, and I thought it would really work on piano.
We're talking with Inara George and Greg Kirsten about their new record of Van Halen covers. Did you rediscover parts of the songs in redoing them that had never struck you before?
I think because in my kid mind, Panama, it was like I was learning about the Panama Canal when I heard that song. So I really thought it was about the Panama Canal. And then you read the lyrics, you're like, oh no, it's about a girl in a car. Of course. It makes you realize, like, you've heard a song so many times and you don't actually listen to the lyrics. There is some music like that. I think Van Halen sort of is in that category for me.
We're going to kind of recreate how you guys put together Panama. So do you remember that day?
This is the thing about these records, these cover records, is really, it's like Greg's kind of brainchild, because when we make our records where we write, a lot of business happens when we're together. But I feel like this, I don't even remember if I was even around when you like got this one going on.
You were definitely around on the vocal parts, that's for sure.
Yes, I was here.
So I could show you some proof of that. Basically, we would use Inara's voice to kind of recreate a lot of the guitar parts. That was sort of the initial idea. So we have this section, which is the intro, and kind of a little Beach Boys inspired, but here's this soloed up. This is Inara stacked. And then it does the little piano thing, and then you have Inara playing the actual main guitar riff, but kind of reharmonized with a little bit of a jazz kind of voicing to it. So let me see what else we have.
That bass,
the funky bass.
The funky bass line.
Let's see if I could find that. So we have basically the chorus that's sounding like this. I'll solo up some. So this is all the music. You have the vocals happening. And then you have like a bass thing going on. What else is here? Well, here's the mini Moog bass. This is without the drums and bringing the drums and everything. That's pretty much what's going on there. And then when you get into the solo section, let's hear what's going on here. Also there, I sampled Inara's voice from the intro, but pitched it up to a different key to kind of fit the key of this part of the song. Then you have this kind of like new wave piano going on here, which just reminds me of the 80s.
and then that section all together. Let's hear that.
Okay.
Yeah, we're running a little bit hot tonight.
Yeah, Nora. Then you have these kind of ascending chords, which I kind of put chords to, which I don't think Eddie really plays exactly those voicings, but I kind of filled out the voicings a little bit more. And that's pretty much it, you know? Yeah.
I'm curious, when you're taking it apart musically, does it change in its meaning lyrically?
I think what was the exciting part about doing this is that this is such a kind of male-focused lyrical. I mean, this song in particular, it was that he is with a woman and he is equating the car and the female together. So I was equating the car as more of a masturbation piece.
As opposed to a sex car.
A sex car, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's a sex car, but it's a solo sex car.
And Aaron Gregg, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The Bird and the Bees Van Halen cover album is out now. And that's it for The Frame Weekend. This show is edited by Darby Maloney and produced by Herb, Jonathan Shiflett, Robert Garova, and Julia Paskin. Valentino Rivera is our engineer. Andrea Gutierrez is our news clerk. Our intern is Paul Ratliff, and our senior producer is Oscar Garza. I'm John Horn, and this has been The Frame Weekend from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We hope you have a great rest of your weekend. We'll be back on Monday with the daily version of The Frame.